So having spoken in chapter 2, which is perhaps his main point, that faith must produce works, it must show itself in action, and of course the action that concerns him is justice, like God's, he then moves in chapter 3 to another section, which is saying that our words must reveal our soul. It's about the tongue, speech, words. Words too have to be real. And they have to reveal the soul, not just be words to obscure, words to say what people might want to think that we're thinking, words that'll please, all the other things we do with words in private life, but in public life it becomes an abhorrent blooming thing that we're just all despairing of. We know that, well, often the case is that we just think the politician has got a minder who is telling him what to say that will impress. I want to know what he's thinking. So do you. But can we get that? Hopefully yes, but it's not easy. So here's James on this subject of the... Not many of you, he says in chapter 3, should become teachers, my brothers and sisters, for you know that we who teach will be judged with greater strictness. For all of us make many mistakes. Anyone who makes no mistakes is in speaking is perfect, able to keep the whole body in check with a bridle. If we put bits into the mouths of horses to make them obey us, we guide their whole bodies. Or look at ships. Though they are so large that it takes strong winds to drive them, they're guided by a very small rudder, wherever the will of the pilot directs. So also the tongue. It's a small member, yet it boasts great exploits. How great a forest is set ablaze by a small fire. This is the poetry of a simple person, really. I mean, poetry mostly goes with being simple. If none of you have had the pleasure, I've had the pleasure of going to Ireland and visiting different people, including some of my relatives, and some of them I don't think they'd ever gone to school. But I just loved sitting there listening to them because they were talking poetry all the time. The natural wisdom of the soil and good sense and all that, and the language, it was just beautiful language. I can see why most of the English dramatists are Irish, if only they'd admit it. But anyhow, here we have James 3, 1-5. This is... So speech is used to flatter the rich. We've already seen that. Come here, sit here, please. May we look after you. We've already heard James say that we say the right things to the poor, but doing nothing. Oh, you poor person, I wish you well, I hope everything goes right, but we do nothing about it. He's already said that in chapter 2. And then also in chapter 2, he said we use the right formulas in claiming to believe. We believe there's one God. But our actions belie our words. Because if you really were a monotheist, you'd treat everyone with immense respect as a temple of God. And we don't. And people in the name of monotheism can murder. So, that's all been said already by James. Let's look a little bit broader and see this. What he's saying here is typical wisdom. Jesus, in Luke 11, "Woe to you lawyers, you've taken away the key of knowledge. You didn't go into in yourselves and you stopped others entering." Words that obscure the truth and lead people in wrong directions. Proverbs 13:3, "Those who guard their mouths preserve their lives. Those who open wide their lips come to ruin." Sirach. Jesus ben Sirach is the author, 200 BC, something like that. Sirach was a wise teacher in Jerusalem, and his son was Jesus, a common name, Joshua, at the time, or right through. And he, writing the wisdom of his father, he says, chapter 22, "Who will set a guard over my mouth, an effective seal upon my lips, so that I may not fall because of them, and my tongue may not destroy me?" And a little later in the same book, "Curse the gossips of the double-tongued, the forked-tongued, for they destroy the peace of many. slander has destroyed strong cities and overturned the houses of the great. And in verse 6, our author James continues, "The tongue is a fire. The tongue is placed among our members as a world of iniquity. It stains the whole body, sets on fire the cycle of nature, and is itself set on fire by hell." That is pretty tough talk. But is he wrong? "For every species of beast and bird, of reptile and sea creature, can be tamed and has been tamed by the human species, but no one can tame the tongue." As I look at you, you're all blushing, so I presume I am too. Now, isn't it common? How many days do we pass not being part of a conversation where someone is being put down and we might join in, or we might do nothing, or we might have a joke? Or how often? This is so common because of our poverty of... "No one can tame the tongue, a restless evil full of deadly poison. With it we bless the Lord and Father, and with it we curse those who are made in the likeness of God. From the same mouth come blessing and cursing. My brothers and sisters, this ought not be so. Does a spring pour forth from the same opening both fresh and brackish water? Can a fig tree, my brothers and sisters, yield olives, or a grapevine figs? No more can salt water yield fresh." He now moves to another point. He's made that point in the traditional language of the Jewish scriptures. And now in verse 13, he comes to a lovely section on our need for conversion. We need change. We need to turn towards God, all of us, more. And so he begins, verse 13. "Who is wise and understanding among you? Show by your good life that your works are done with gentleness, born of wisdom. But if you have bitter envy and selfish ambition in your hearts, don't be boastful and false to the truth. Such wisdom does not come down from above. It is earthly, unspiritual." The Greek is just psychikos, meaning it comes from your own psyche. Its source is my own human psyche, thinking, pondering, knowledge. It doesn't come from God. And if things come from our own ego, they will be distorted, they'll be ungraced. It's devilish, demonish. "For where there is envy and selfish ambition, there will also be disorder and wickedness of every kind." I'll just give you a little background to that text before we come to the beautiful climax of chapter 3, which is the next section. So here he talks in this chapter 3, verse 13 to 16, talks about wisdom firstly, and I think I mentioned last week, may have been in another lecture, that wisdom is always related to revelation. Those two words have to be held together in the same semantic field. Wisdom is the openness to listen to revelation. Wisdom is the ability to see God in situations, whatever they are, on a cross of Calvary or on a transfiguration mountain, whatever the experience, somewhere God is in that experience. And to locate God properly is the art of wisdom. And many of us fall short of it. So that's what wisdom is. And here's Jesus saying, he talks there in verse 13, he relates wisdom to gentleness. Let me just look at it again. Your works are done with gentleness, born of wisdom. So, gentleness, praotes. We find it a couple of times, or many times, but here is the loveliest text I know where it occurs is in Jesus, in Matthew chapter 11, verse 29, at the end of that long section where we see the Messiah being rejected. And Jesus at the end doesn't retaliate, doesn't try and vindicate himself at all. He just says, come to me, all you who labor and are heavily burdened, and I will give you rest. Learn from me, for I am, here it is, gentle and humble in heart. So, beautiful qualities of the heart of Jesus. Gentleness is one of them. It's contrasted with, he translates it here, envy. I would rather translate it jealousy. The distinction isn't always clear. I think it should be clear. I'll give you what I think the distinction is, and you can check it for yourself. See, the Greek is zelos, and zelos technically means zeal. That's what it actually means. It sounds like it too. We get our word from it. So it's zeal. Zelos, however, sometimes is used, because zeal can be a good thing, of course. Sometimes it's used for the energy of protecting my own, what I am and who I am and what I've got. And then that's jealousy. As far as I'm able to discern, though it's so abused in our language now it's lost its distinction, you are jealous of what you have, you are envious of what you don't have. That's the distinction. So I'm jealous if someone's dancing with my wife because she's mine and I don't want anyone else to be dancing with her. Take a typical kind of jealousy. Or you're jealous. You don't want others to share what you've got. You want to hold it and gives you. Whereas if I don't have it and I want it, that's envy. Well, I think he's talking about jealousy here. It's a form of zeal which arises out of selfish ambition, which is unspiritual in the sense that it has its origin not in God, but in the divided human psyche and is lured by desire. As he says already in chapter 1 about temptation, it's your own desire to hold, to possess, to keep for yourself. That's the problem, not gentleness. Here's Paul using, I think, similar range of meanings. He says in Romans chapter 2, verse 8, those who are self-seeking and who do not obey the truth, he talks about. I think that's the same kind of stuff that James is talking about in jealousy. Seeking self and not listening to the whole truth. Philippians 2:3, do nothing from selfish ambition or conceit, but in humility regard others as better than yourselves. It's not a bad way to presume, to start from that assumption that they are, because you'll generally be right. And 2 Corinthians 12:20, Paul says, I fear that when I come I may find you not as I wish and that you may find me not as you wish. I fear that perhaps there may be among you quarreling, jealousy, anger, selfishness, slander, gossip, conceit and disorder. A fair few of those too are sins of the tongue, or the heart expressed in the tongue. So, here we have, to conclude, James is talking about lacking wisdom, not being in connection with God, not seeing where God is, but out of our insecurity or our self-serving or out of ambition or whatever selfishness, we're putting our energy into self-serving, I guess. Then he concludes with one of the loveliest little statements in the scriptures, and it concludes our session today when he says what real wisdom is. And I'll try and open it up for you. The wisdom from above, now that's the kind of wisdom we'd all want, is Then he runs through 8 qualities, and I'll take you through them slowly. It's pure. There's a lot of words for pure in Greek. The Greek here is hagnos, which is pure in quite a precise way. It's cultic purity. It means something is pure, means it's been taken from the koinos, from the common use, and it's been set aside for God. Pure. It's a strict meaning of it. So therefore it might be a possession, it might be a bowl, it might be first fruits, it might be an animal, it might be a person who's taken away from the ordinary daily ins and outs of life and consecrated to God. So it means being in communion with God, unstained by the world. Paul uses this same word when he says to the Corinthians, I promised you in marriage to one husband, speaking of the community, to present you as a chaste virgin to Christ, that all your love will be for him. But that word chaste is hagnos, same as the word used here, pure, not contaminated. And here John uses it in perhaps the loveliest line where it occurs in the New Testament. In his first letter, chapter 3, verse 3, he ends up by saying, I want you to be pure, hagnos, as pure as Christ. The way Christ is pure, I want that for you. So it's a beautiful word, as I'm sure you'd agree. So wisdom that comes from above is pure. It's peaceable, the second quality. Jesus, in the Blessed are the peacemakers, they will be called children of God. And peace, once again, means what? It means harmony. The best image I'm aware of for peace is an orchestra at the end of the Emperor Concerto or something. And every single instrument is there giving its absolute full best. It's right, the tone is right, the note is correct. Not everyone's doing the same, of course, it would be quite... But everyone's doing something different, but every single person in the orchestra is watching the orchestra meister, and they're also playing with sensitivity to everyone around them so that the tuba doesn't make too much noise and you can't drown out the violins or whatever. Everything is... So peace means a community where there's respect for each one, welcoming of each one, and everyone's tuned in to everybody else. It's a lovely image, but that's what shalom means. So wisdom from above is peaceable. Big word. In English it's not so big. Peace in English comes from the same word as pact. It comes from the Roman. And peace in Rome, the technical word, just means a space in between violence. Like, normally there's war, but now there's no war, so you call that peace. Because nothing's happening. You don't need the army. Well, no. Shalom is something richer and more broad. All the lambkins are gambling on the fields, and all the wheat is abundant, and the rain is there, and the rivers are glistening, and everything in nature and everything in the heavens and everything in human beings is wholesome. The kind of stuff we'd all want and are working for, please God. That's peace. Third, I've forgotten what it is in the New Jerusalem, but in the file I can find here, the New Revised Version. It's not a very... I think it says gentle. Gentle, yes. Well, we've already had the word gentle, and this isn't the same word. Protes is gentle. This is a different word. Epieikes. In fact, we get the word in English, you may not have heard it, you do in moral theology, epikaia is a technical word in moral theology. So I'll explain what epieikes is, and then you can put your own word. I think the nearest Latin word is clement. This virtue is the virtue of an administrator, or of a magistrate, or of a judge, who doesn't just judge according to black and white of the law, right, wrong, but takes into consideration, which of course the magistrate, thank God, in our system is supposed to do, and often does, of course, takes into consideration all the circumstances. So I might have committed the same crime as you, but we may be in totally different situations. I may have done it cold-bloodedly for ambition. You may have done it in a moment of passion. Well, it's a different crime altogether and shouldn't be treated the same way, as you'd agree. So epieikeia is clemency, and that's the word the Latins use for it. Clemency meaning not softness, not untruth, but a broad-minded openness to the reality of what's happening, and the judgment is based on the whole situation, including the people involved and all the weaknesses and all the background and all of that, so that the judgment made is just. It's equity, real judgment. So that's wisdom that comes from above has this character of clemency about it. Paul uses it in Titus. Avoid quarrelling, be clement. That's my translation, because it's not a very commonly used English word, but it's the best I can come up with from its Latin background anyhow. And show every courtesy to everyone. Fourthly, the wisdom that comes from above, what a lovely thing to pray for, is willing to yield. That's how he translates it quite well. Willing to yield. So it isn't stubborn, holding on to my opinion because it's mine, defending a position because it's the one I'm in. The one I'm in may actually be wrong. So if you can bring up an argument to show me I'm wrong and I still defend where I am, then I'm not interested in truth. I'm only interested in defending where I am. Whereas wisdom yields when it can be shown that the truth is other. And if you're a person, I'm a person who gradually want the truth more than anything, even when it's very embarrassing to us, or when it means we've got to admit fault, or when it's a lovely quality. Fifthly, wisdom that comes from above is full of mercy and good fruits. Well, he's been making that point in the whole of chapter 2. It's full of good fruits and mercy, eleos. And then he says two negative things about it. Not negative, but two... Not, it's not two things, wisdom. It's not divided. It's not duplex. It's not like a piece of string that's got two strands to it and they're twisted around and you can't see what it's doing. It's simplex. It's got one line and you can see it, which direction it's going in. Not twisted. So it's not divided. It's not hypocritical. Hypocritical comes from the word, I presume you know. It comes from the mask worn by an actor in a Roman or Greek drama. Keep in mind, however, this is quite important. I didn't know this at the beginning, but I came to it when I was doing drama at the university to realize that the mask that was worn by the actor was not meant to hide, it was meant to reveal. That's a really big insight. I mean, a simple insight, but a good one. Because, for example, I walk on stage and I'm Agamemnon. Well, I want you to see Agamemnon, not me. It's not... give us the name of an actor today. Somebody that's famous, I don't know. Who is it? Branagh. Oh, yes. Kenneth Branagh. You can't do better. Right. Well, you're not going to see Kenneth Branagh. You're going to see Henry VIII, or Henry IV, or Henry V, thank you. King. So Henry V, Richard, whatever. So you're going to see that. So the mask is meant to portray that in the Greek theatre, because it was a big theatre and they didn't have picture shows. You had to see from the back. And as soon as the mask put on, everyone said, that's Agamemnon, that's Iphigenia. Just they knew by the mask. All right. So the mask was what was worn by the actor. Well, of course, it doesn't take long to get the image wearing a mask. Who are you? Who are you showing yourself to be? Are you showing yourself to be other than you are? So in ordinary everyday life, it comes to mean hypocritical, giving off an impression and hiding behind the impression, because the impression, what seems, is not what is. Well, wisdom that comes from above is not like that. It's not masked. It's sincere. That's not a good word now that I think of it, because you know what that comes from, don't you? You know how they had... Cera in Latin means wax. So you have a marble statue which has got cracks in it, and you put a bit of wax on it, and it appears perfect, but it actually has got a break in it. So sincere means without wax. I mean, it's all marble. There's no putty filling in the cracks. There's actually no cracks. Okay. But anyhow, it's not divided, it's not hypocritical, and his final statement about the wisdom that comes as a gift from God is, it bears a harvest of righteousness, is sown in peace for those who make peace. Those who make peace means contribute to building a community in which everyone is respected, everyone is encouraged to give their gift, everyone's gift is welcome, and everyone's gift is held in a harmony that is a loving harmony of the community.